two quick things before we start the show. First, we had a special guest on this time, and before we started the show, I asked him, how do you want to be introduced? And he actually said, go ahead and use my full name. And as I was listening to the show, putting it together, I realized I only used his first name. So the Bruce I refer to in the rest of this podcast is Bruce Morton, who's also on Twitter as BYU Fan, if you're interested in following him. And we introduce the rest of the stuff about him later. Also, one of the three of us on the show had something going on with their microphone that caused a little distortion and a little bit of weirdness here and there. I actually suspect it was probably my microphone, but I don't know for sure. Anyway, it's a little distracting at times. Sorry about that. Work your way through it. Nothing I could do to make it better, really. I could have tried, but I probably would have made things worse. So anyway, here's the show. Enjoy. Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, October 21st, 2012. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is with us, and we have a special guest with us this week. You all may remember that last week on the show, and the week before, we've sort of said, hey, we want to get a Romney supporter on the show, both Yvonne and I have our views, but neither one of us are seriously considering Romney. And so we wanted to bring balance. So I also posted something on Twitter, and Bruce answered, but not as a Romney supporter. He asked, do you want somebody who can, to make the case for Johnson, who's running as a Libertarian? And I said, sure, love to have you on. So a little bit of background. Bruce is was a former co-chair of the Republicans in the 44th Legislative District here in Washington State. He was also a campaign coordinator for the Ron Paul campaign in our area. And so he brings that context to it. And so we'll start out with some other things, but a little bit later on in the show, we'll ask Bruce to sort of make the Libertarian case for why you wouldn't want to vote for either Obama and Romney. And this resonates for me because I've said on the show before, while I've never seriously considered Romney, he's just too far away from where I am on a lot of things. I do want to seriously consider Johnson, and I sort of consider myself at this point undecided between Obama and Johnson. And so it'll be an interesting conversation. I sort of have the feeling that Johnson probably matches better with a lot of my viewpoints. But then there's the usual practical considerations about a third party. So anyway,
we'll get into that later.
Okay. We'll talk about the little quiz and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Right.
So first of all, we just want to start out with the usual update of where things are in my modeling. We'll try to make this pretty quick. I actually have not yet posted the update for Sunday as of the time we're recording this. I was almost done. I was trying to make it before recording the podcast, but didn't quite do it.
Well, I don't think it's going to matter. I think it'll be up before people listen to it, so we're okay.
You know, by the time people listen to this, all kinds of things will have happened, probably.
Right.
Although, yes. I'm going to try really hard to get this out before the third debate on Monday night, but we'll see. Bottom line is we've seen some Obama recovery since the second debate, and part of my update today relates to that because Florida flipped from being just slightly leaning Romney to just slightly leaning Obama in my update today that I'm going to post soon. But the key is just slightly. Really, Florida's too close to call. It can go either way. But if you look at my summary, the Romney best case is still to win. Romney can win here. Basically, if he gets North Carolina, Virginia, New Hampshire, all of which he's ahead in, Florida, which he was ahead in until today's update and is now just barely behind by a sliver, and then if you give him all of those, and he manages to win Ohio, where he's ahead, where he's behind by only a percent or so, he wins. So Romney's winning scenario is very much viable. Romney can win. His best case, if he wins all of the close states, is to win 315 to 223. But winning all of the close states is probably really a stretch. If everybody just wins everywhere, they're heading right now, according to the polls, in my five poll averages, Obama does win 315 to 223. That includes Florida, which is a pretty substantial bit right there. And as I mentioned, that's just barely Obama's best case if he wins all of the close states is to win 347 to 191. That includes him actually taking North Carolina, Virginia, and New Hampshire away from Romney. So we have seen some, you know, this whole situation is better for Obama than it was before the second debate when sort of it looked like Romney's had his local peak. But make no mistake about it. It is still really, really, really close.
Yeah, I mean,
a month ago,
if you look at all the different like sites and even like, for example, the stock index that tracks probability of the election. I mean, you know, it had tightened significantly, but the gap, you know, started widening a little bit, especially in the last few days. Now, you know, of course, the question is, you know, a lot of people have been making, you know, some assumptions whether, look, is this because the bounce simply from the debate that Romney got is waving off, or is it an impact of the second debate? I'm actually of the belief, to be honest with you, that before even like what happened in the second debate, I think that there was probably some fading of the bounce that Romney got in the first debate. Okay,
there was some evidence of that before the debate, and in some of my updates, I believe I showed that. But you know, the thing is though, the second debate, it's still like, you know, it takes a while for the results of these things to get baked into the polls, especially if you're looking at state level polls rather than national.
Right,
and so really, we're gonna have one more debate, you know, a little over 24 hours from now as we record this show.
Which, by the way, I did not get invited, finally.
Yvonne had mentioned offline that he almost got invited to actually physically attend that third debate.
There was somebody that was getting an allotment of, you know, there was going to be able to get some tickets, but I guess the tickets wound up going to somebody else.
Oh, well. In any case, you know, before the first debate, this was looking like an Obama runaway. The first debate, he threw that all away. You know, there was a lot of evidence that he was perhaps peaking anyway, and we were due for some reversion to the mean. His peak was actually about
a
week before the first debate. But the first debate just, you know, boom. Suddenly we have a race. And anyway, that's where we are with that. And yeah, you know, we'll see what happens with the third debate.
Now, I will say this, that being in Florida, like right now, versus I just had my brother who just flew in from Texas, okay? You know, it's kind of a funny thing, you know? So I'm in a battleground state, right? So I pick up my brother at the airport. We're driving through, like, I-95 headed north, okay, towards Boca, where the debate, like, driving actually to where the other debate is, to be precise, exactly where it is. So we're heading over there, and my brother was like, damn, look at all these election billboards. And he was like, what do you say that? I was like, well, in Texas, there are none. And, you know, I realized it's kind of funny. I mean, let's face it. I mean, Texas is, you know, isn't no contention whatsoever. I mean,
the same kind of thing for the most part here in Washington. I mean, there's a corner near my house that I drive by any day, and it's plastered with election signs for local elections. And right. I was looking, and there's not a single Obama sign, not a single Romney sign, not a single Johnson sign, for that matter. It was all local
yeah,
on that corner.
Everything on the highway. Some guy who has this pack. Okay, I can't remember what the name of it is, but they've got this pack that has been pushing this whole thing about the price of gasoline when Obama took over to where it is now. And I'm telling you, this guy managed to buy at least 50% of the billboards in the stretch between Fort Lauderdale and Boca Raton have this billboard with, like, the price of gas when he was there, the price of gas now, and Obama bowing in front of some Arab, okay, that I can't identify, okay? Uh-huh. All right? And that's what the billboard is, like, all the way across. It's just hilarious. I'm like, Jesus. I mean, really? And I'm like, you know, but the thing is, you know, the thing about the numbers where they are, with the number of undecideds and some of the stuff, I will say this, where people's heads are, okay, especially with some of the undecideds, that kind of stuff, I will say this, even though it may not be, you know, it's really twisting some facts to your advantage, I got to think that it is working on some people. I really do, okay, because I think they do believe it, okay? You know, that's all directly related to the president. But, you know,
well, look, I mean, political advertising is, you know, people spend money on it because it does work. The negative ads on both sides, the distortions on both sides, you know, the reason people do it is because it does indeed work.
Yeah, I know.
And it's amazing because if you just think for 2 seconds about why gas was so cheap, it's because we were in a nosedive.
Yeah, I know, exactly. That's what I'm saying. So I'm like, that's what I was saying to people. I'm like, well, should we just try to incite another big economic crash now? And maybe price of gas down again.
And gas prices 6 months before the election of Obama, 4 years ago, was that higher than they were now. So it's like,
or close to it anyway.
Well,
so.
And this is in general one of those things where people tend to attribute to the president all sorts of things which really have nothing to do with them. Even the basic, like, let's talk about the economy. Is the economy up, down, sideways? The president has some marginal impact on that. But for the most part, you know, hey, the Fed has a bigger impact on that than the president does. And there's all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, but that's what people see. And, you know, people don't study it that much. So it is what it is. I mean, you know, it's like people make decisions on that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. So anyway, let's move in real quick before we move to what we brought Bruce in here for Johnson. Let's talk a little bit about the second debate. I know, Yvonne, last week you made a big deal out of not watching most of the debates, but you actually by chance ended up watching the second debate or a big part of it.
I actually did, okay, because my wife put it on the TV. Uh-huh. Okay. So this is what she does. She goes and she puts it on the TV, right? So I can't watch, you know, whatever the heck I wanted to watch. And then she actually goes and, like, 20 minutes into the debate, actually walks out of the room and stops watching it. And starts playing on the computer, okay? So listening to iTunes. And I'm like, okay, really? I'm like, so anyway, I already watched 20, 30 minutes of it. So I watched most. I mean, I watched the darn thing. But, you know, look, the debate came down to, I think that if you see it, like I've said before about what most debates are, if nothing major happens, it really just it's a non-event. It's just energizing each other's base. There's no way that a guy like Obama or a guy like Romney is going to convince a guy who already made his decision for one candidate or the other that they're going to be swayed by a lot of the arguments that are made at a lot of these debates. Because most of these debates are really about people just pushing their agenda significantly and not really about debating relevant facts or their positions, for that matter, or answering any of the questions from the people that actually pose them, for God's sake.
Well, their
positions are so close that they end up arguing over the piddliest things, like whether or not Obama said the word terror in Rose Garden.
Right.
Not stepping back and saying, hey, how did we get into this situation in the first place?
Right. And that was not an issue at all. And I'm like, that's one of the things that I scratched my head as why Romney pushed that so hard, when I'm like, okay, you don't want to like actually debate the policy. You just want to try to catch him in him saying that he said something, but not, that's it.
Well, yeah, because for the most part, and we'll see this, I guess, in the foreign policy debate this coming week, but on foreign policy, there's almost no daylight between these guys. I mean, there's some slight changes in the margin, and like the Republicans tend to want to be a little bit more bellicose in the things they say and sort of threaten people a little bit more. But when you actually get down to, okay, but what would you actually do? It's, it's almost exactly the same.
Right. And so, yeah, but regardless, I mean, bottom line is that the debate, at least at this point, was something that I don't think, you know, unless you're truly, really an undecided, I mean, I even those people, I think a lot of the undecideds, even at this step of the campaign, are leaning one way or another anyway.
They are, and like study after study have shown that like the people who self-identify as undecided, or for that matter, independent, for the most part, really aren't. They really do have a significant leaning one way or the other. They just don't want to reveal their true preference until sort of the very last moment. But also the people who really and truly are undecided are also the people who are unlikely to vote and are low information and don't know what's going on anyway and probably won't watch the debate.
Or probably won't vote at all.
Yeah, I mean, they might not. They probably won't. There was an interesting poll done. It was a couple months ago now that specifically targeted unlikely voters. You know, because you know our typical turnout at American elections, I forget, it's slightly above or below 50%, but it's fairly low. You know, and so like tons and tons and tons of people just never vote. And if you actually like got those people to vote, you'd have very different results. And what this particular poll said that was among unlikely voters, Obama actually had a very significant advantage to the point where if all those people who don't vote actually did vote, this wouldn't even be close. But, you know, that's not what we have, you know?
That's right.
And frankly, you know, I've always been of mixed minds about that and said, do we really want people who don't know what's going on voting, or are we better off with the people who pay attention voting?
You want to do like testing for people to vote? We would do some exams like right outside a quiz.
I've actually thought about that at times, but I think self-selection is okay. The people who don't give a damn and don't pay attention and decide not to vote, I think that's okay. It's okay for them not to vote.
Okay.
The sad thing is that we shouldn't have to care. You know, the government shouldn't be affecting our daily lives anyway. And so if both candidates were actually going to obey the Constitution, we wouldn't care.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Bruce, do you have any additional thoughts on the second debate other than what you've chimed in with so far?
No, but I do want to mention something about the third debate.
Yep.
I find it surprising that it's being held in Boca Raton, Florida, if no other reason that I grew up there, and it's being held at Lynn University, which is like walking distance from where I went to high school. And so it's just kind of weird. And,
oh, that's funny.
I didn't know that.
Okay, well, I don't know if you... Well, that's what I said. I live in Boca. It's funny that you actually grew up in Boca. That's funny.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
So, okay, let's take a break, and then when we come back, Bruce will let you talk a little bit about Johnson and what brought you to him and why you think everybody else should consider him too. So we'll be right back after this quick break.
Okay.
Ready for the test, Dracula? I'm ready. Frankenstein, then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we're back. And Yvonne had to leave us. Yvonne actually had given me a heads up right before we started the show that his baby was acting up a little bit and he might need to step away or just leave completely to help out with the baby. I guess he's not feeling too well or whatever. But, you know, he'll be fine. Just, you know, one of those baby things. They happen. I've just got Bruce with me now. Let's start with, you know, before you start like trying to convince me and trying to convince everybody else, give us the background. I remember following him a bit during the very early stages of the Republican primary process. But who is this Johnson guy?
Okay. Yeah. Gary Johnson, he started out as a handyman. I'm not sure at what age, but he started this business in New Mexico, and he grew the business to the point where he was able to sell it off for quite a sum. And then he decided, I don't know exactly why, but he decided to get into politics. And he decided to jump in and go for an open seat for being governor in New Mexico. I believe this was in, I don't even want to say the year, but all I know is that he served two terms as governor in New Mexico. He was a nobody buddy politically, and he was told that that he would never have a, wouldn't have a chance. But when he got in the debates, he ended up getting a lot of support. And he, while governor, he vetoed more bills than any other governor in I think at least that state's history, if not any state in the union. And the and then when he was elected to a second term, he won by landslide. He was very popular because he held government, state government, to grow very slowly. And in fact, he actually shrunk the government. And he was very successful there. And he decided that, well, once he left office, I believe it was in 2008 that he left office, he had a long-term plan to run for president. So he started preparing then, and he's been, for the last few years, he's been running around the country on a speaking tour. I forget the Something America Initiative. I forgot. He had an organization before his campaign to kind of, like, it was like a pre-campaign.
It was the Our America Initiative. I just
looked. Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, when he ran for governor, I mean, when he ran in the primaries, in the Republican presidential primary, he really didn't even get considered seriously, even though he was a popular two-term governor of a swing state, or at least it used to be a swing state, and which conceivably gives him more executive experience than both Romney and Obama combined.
Well, at least before Obama was actually president.
Well, no, even now. Because he was,
In terms of time, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So I've seen that on his advertising, but you know, that's kind of like, all right. But anyway, as far as his positions go, he is staunchly small government, and one of his main points is for marijuana legalization. Mm-hmm. He has seen how the drug war has affected this country, and how the drug war has done a lot more damage than the drugs themselves. And he has pushed marijuana legalization, not the legalization of all drugs. And I think that, as we can see in this state of Washington, Colorado, Oregon, we may end up having a sea change on the attitude in this country on illegal drugs, and especially marijuana.
Yeah, but polls I've seen in terms of marijuana legalization specifically, leaving aside other drugs, are that the long-term trend is the percentage of people who approve of legalization has steadily increased year after year after year, and nationwide it's approaching the 50% mark right now. But because of various institutional inertia and barriers and such, it probably has to get significantly higher than 50% before you have anything happen on a national level. But the trend is definitely in that direction, and you see a number of states moving forward, you know, despite whatever the federal government is doing along those lines. Another chart I saw recently that I found was very interesting. Basically had two lines on the chart. One was spending on, you know, basically the drug war, whatever you want to call it, on interventions aimed at, you know, drug issues, which was increasing steadily over the last few decades. And then another line on the chart, you know, say basically incidence of drug addiction, you know, diagnosed medically, et cetera, which was basically flat during the time period, which basically shows that whatever we're doing, whatever we're spending, you know, even on a purely utilitarian argument, is at best having no effect whatsoever, being a complete waste of resources. And then, of course, there are a lot of arguments showing the damage it does as well. But anyway, so there's one issue. Sorry, go on.
So, yeah, that's his main issue, and it's kind of the one that really distinguishes him, because all the other Republicans, except for Ron Paul maybe, you know, kept away from the issue with a 10-foot pole.
Now, is that really sort of his number one issue that he's pushing? Because it surprises me that, like, you know, there are a number of sort of libertarian-ish positions to push in a lot of different areas. You know, the sort of The civil liberties angle, the anti-war angle, there are a lot of other areas that you could push, and it seems like this is one that's like traditionally sort of been looked at as, even if you can make the rational argument for it, people who make these kinds of arguments tend to be easily painted as, oh, they just want to smoke pot.
yeah, and you know, and you know, that was his main issue during the primaries. I don't think it's the same thing now because I've not seen him mention it as much. But yeah, in the case of Governor Johnson, yeah, he actually did smoke pot. Mm-hmm. And
as did Obama.
As did Obama. And not that he's saying that he still wants to smoke pot now. Of course, he wouldn't admit that now. So the but yeah, more recently in the general election, he is pushing the fact that he is the alternative, or the, or what he would like people to see as the alternative to Ron Paul. And he wants to be able to carry the banner. I'm sure he would just love to get Ron Paul's endorsement. And when asked about whether he would like Ron Paul's endorsement, he says, no, I'm not asking for Ron Paul's endorsement, but I readily endorsed him. Well, this is what he would say. He said that he readily endorsed Ron Paul in 2008 and 2012 when he left the race. And he goes on about many other things, kind of hinting that it would be polite for Ron Paul to reciprocate.
And I've noticed he's very, you know, I've a little bit less lately, but certainly in a few months ago, on Gary Johnson's Twitter feed and various other things where I've seen him, he was constantly sort of trying to engage in the Ron Paul discussions and sort of put himself in there as, hey, you know, I'm over here too. What do you say, like, there are definitely some similarities, but he's not Ron Paul. What would you say the differences are? We'll get to differences between him and Obama and Romney, but since you brought up the Ron Paul comparison, how is he different from Ron Paul? In what areas, in terms of positions, does he differ?
Well, first of all, before let's speak about positions, he's not a philosopher. Mm. Ron Paul is. There was an interview that he had several months ago with someone from the von Mises Institute, and he was asked about the books that he's read, his feelings of, or his views on different libertarian writers and such, and he really was not up to speed on, at least in the interviewer's mind, on all of the philosophical basis of libertarianism. Mm-hmm. And his positions on war were not staunchly anti-war. He still sees a need for maintaining a strong military, and which is, you know, to an anarcho-capitalist, which is really the von Mises Institute kind of position. Not wanting to get rid of the entire military is anathema. They're very purist. So I'd say actually from a philosophical standpoint, he's not a guru like Ron Paul is seen as, and he's not able to speak on the fundamentals of position. He's more of a practical perspective.
And I'll tell you, from my point of view, as someone who's always sort of had libertarian leanings, has voted for libertarian a couple times for president, my biggest problem oftentimes when considering libertarians are the folks who are so doctrinaire that they seem detached somewhat from actual reality. Like, yeah, okay, you can go through this philosophical argument and outline this position where there's almost no government and you do... And you have sort of the free market works its will and blah blah blah, but like I look at some of those positions and say, okay, that's wonderful, I guess, but like let's talk about the real world. And so I've always sort of wanted to have someone who has strong libertarian tendencies, but then is sort of grounded in the actual real life political situation of today, makes concessions to reality, makes concessions that, you know, hey, not everything's going to go this way, and maybe there is some legitimate role of government in this or that or this, and is actually sort of one way I would put it is a moderate libertarian as opposed to a radical libertarian.
And that is exactly who Johnson is. Mm-hmm. Johnson, he's a libertarian, not because of his philosophical basis, but because it's from a practical perspective, it makes sense. He has said that he looks at every government program from a cost-benefit analysis, and that's how he approached his veto decisions while governor. And so I would say from a policy perspective, that is probably the main difference between him and Ron Paul. He'd be more willing to work with the government systems that we have and to not try to just eliminate everything wholesale.
You mentioned the military. Are there other places where Johnson explicitly says, you know, this is actually a good place for government to be involved?
I think I mentioned earlier, he's only recently become more anti-war. His earlier mm-hmm. positions were that he's willing to maintain the empire, but. As far as his positions there, I wouldn't be able to speak to details on that.
So, let's see. We did the comparison with Ron Paul. Mm-hmm. What are the main? You know, if he actually was on the stage with Obama and Romney at any one of these debates, what are the areas where you'd see him distinctly different from one or both of them?
Well, you know, that's a very good question because tomorrow night, let me see. No, it's Tuesday night, isn't it? I think
it's Monday night. Tomorrow night.
Yeah, there's the debate between Romney and Obama is tomorrow night, but I believe he's doing on something Tuesday night. Okay. There's a four-way debate between the Libertarian Party, Green Party, and the Constitution Party, and the one that Rocky Anderson is in, the Justice Party, I believe. So that should be interesting. I'm not sure if I'll be able to catch that. I'm sure I'll listen to it afterwards. But
do you know where that is? Yeah, is that going to be on C-SPAN or somewhere? Or online somewhere?
Well, I'm sure it's going to be online somewhere. It's being held in Chicago, I believe. I believe it's on Tuesday night. So sorry, okay. I'm not. The speed on that.
You know, and I've been saying time after time again for the last few months that, you know, I want to seriously consider Johnson, but I feel like I haven't done my homework yet. I haven't had time because I want to dive in. I want to read all the stuff on his website. Watching a debate like this would be a critical component in something like that, too. Actually hear the guy talk directly about these issues because, you know, from my point of view, I'll tell you where I am. I would call myself a liberal leaning libertarian in that, there's been talk of, you know, libertarians are typically identified as people who want less government involvement, both in social and in economic. Whereas liberals are all about leaving you free on your social issues, but doing all kinds of economic intervention, and conservatives like being involved in social issues but want less involvement on economic issues. That's a very rough portrait. Mm-hmm. But on the side of those things, I tend to find myself libertarian leaning, but when it comes into, okay, what kinds of interventions are okay, I care a lot less about the economic stuff than I do about the social stuff if push comes to shove. You know, I do care about the economic stuff. I think that government should only be involved when it really needs to. But, you know, if push comes to shove, I care more about the sort of social issues than the economic issues, which is the reverse of where the libertarian, sort of official libertarian party tends to be. Like, if they have to choose between emphasizing one issue or another, the economic stuff usually takes the forefront.
Traditionally, that has been the case.
Right. So that's where I'm coming from. So I look at Obama, for instance, And I don't mind the healthcare stuff so much. I think, you know, hey, there probably is a legitimate role of government in healthcare. I feel the same way about education. But then I look at, you know, the continuation of the Bush policies on indefinite detention of prisoners, of going after even American citizens on just suspicion of terrorism, on all kinds of surveillance, warrantless wiretapping, all kinds of additional levels of secrecy. And I'm like, I don't like that at all. You know, and Johnson is the only one out there of the major, not of the major, but of the even minor party candidates who's really pushing on that side of things, you know, whereas you get complete agreement between Romney and Obama on this kind of thing. Of course, we're going to do all this stuff to go after Al-Qaeda, and we'll do whatever it takes, and, you know, we're stomping on people's rights. Oh, well, it's what we have to do for safety. And I just don't buy that at all, which is why I you know, consider someone like Johnson highly. I also tend to agree on the drug war type questions and all kinds of other issues as well. So I mean, he's appealing in those areas, and I look at that and see it's an utter shame that there aren't people on the stage on these debates. I mean, I'd love to see Johnson and Stein and these folks, you know, even if they have no chance of winning, just stating some of those views with that level of exposure next to these guys and calling them out on the issues where they actually agree, I think would be immensely useful.
Oh yeah. It would be very educational for the country. But of course, ever since Ross Perot, that's just not going to happen because of what happened.
I mean, they let Ross Perot in and, oh, yeah, everything exploded. Now, of course, they did. The reason they let Ross Perot in the first place is because, you know, his level in the he was so high in the polls, he could not be ignored.
He was ahead of Bush at one point.
He was ahead of, he was in the lead amongst the three of them at one point in the polls. And then he sort of blew himself up, too.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and I was a Perot voter in 92 to disclose that. But yeah, he's, you know, then the Presidential Commission on Debates took over from the League of Women Voters, and they will make damn sure that doesn't happen again unless there's absolutely no choice.
Which is the reason why I was created in the first place.
Yes, yes,
and
very
so,
much so.
And that leads into a lot of the reason why I'm voting for Gary Johnson.
Okay, let's take a quick break again, and then you can summarize some of those arguments, and we'll see if there's anything else to talk about too. But let's take a quick break because we've been going a little while.
Sounds good.
You
I just want to ask you a question. What is your listenership?
Oh, very small. This is completely done as a hobby. You know, so we're lucky if we get a few dozen.
Okay. Well, that's, I didn't even know you had a podcast. I've been following your Twitter feed for months.
Yeah. So no, it's a weekly podcast. We've been doing it for about 5 years now. And so, yeah, probably on an average week, yeah, we get like 25, 30 people listening, or at least downloading it. Who knows if they actually listen. Sometimes we peak higher, especially when there's election stuff going on. Sometimes we go lower when I'm being really bad and not releasing it until later in the week. So, you know.
Well, I guess I'll have to add you to my long list of feeds that I listen to. So,
well, thank you. Yeah. So, anyway, we're back and, so for all our listeners out there, I revealed the magic numbers. Although it's, I actually have, there's a chart somewhere on my website of the listenership. Although I don't, I tend to get a little bit behind. So for instance, I haven't actually checked on the number of downloads, since for like 3 months. So I don't know how it's been doing the last couple months, but anyway, usually it goes up when there's election stuff going on. So
cool.
Anyway, so, What's the bottom line case for Johnson? Let's try to put it in a position of someone who has never really considered anybody other than the two major parties. Because, hey, everybody says, yeah, that's what it is. And you never hear about these other guys. Why would I consider somebody else? Even if, let's say I'm leaning one way or another slightly, but I'm not like a diehard partisan.
Well, this gets back to strategy. If you look back on the 92 election, just to give you some context, Ross Perot, he ended up with 19% of the vote. He was doubtless the reason why Clinton was able to win the election. And so the Republicans were very upset that Ross Perot came and basically stole the election from them and handed it to Bill Clinton. And so Ross Perot is forever reviled in the Republican Party.
And I've mentioned this on the show previously. Like, if I hadn't voted for Ross Perot in 92, I almost certainly would have voted for George H.W. Bush.
Okay. Yep. And same thing for me. And so look what happened. Ross Perot lost, but what was the end result? Ross Perot's number one issue was he wanted to reduce the deficit. Yeah. And so the Republican Party was, they learned their lesson. And what happened 2 years later? It took over House and Senate. And the way they were able to do so was the Contract with America. And included in the Contract with America was a balanced budget amendment, along with many other fiscally responsible acts. And they ended up passing them all, even though Clinton vetoed many of them.
Well, they brought them all up to a vote. Not all of them actually passed, but if I remember correctly. And in the Contract to America, actually, the only promise made was to bring them to a vote, and it was completely met in that sense. Mm-hmm. But I think you're absolutely right, though. And not just the Republicans. The Democrats were running scared from that, too. You know, a lot of the deals that did happen relating to the budget ended up being bipartisan, and the reason they ended up being bipartisan was both parties were scared to death of the Perot voters.
Yep.
And so they both were like, "Oh shit, we have to pay attention to this."
So we ended up going from a $250 billion deficit to an approximately $250 billion surplus in the 8 years after Ross Perot lost the election. And the reason for that is because the parties, even though they were upset with Ross Perot, they respected and desired his voters. And so what they did is they did what they needed to do to get those voters. They didn't move the entire party over onto, they didn't adopt the Reform Party platform,
right,
but they moved over just enough to get those votes. And so looking to today, if you're, first of all, whoever you vote for, you should vote for whoever agrees most with your positions, no matter what. But even if you are wondering, oh no, I might, you know, turn the election over to Obama or over to Romney, if, you know, depending on what your second choice would be,
right?
Then look at it in the context of what happened with Ross Perot, and then also 8 years later with what's the guy who was the Green Party candidate? Nader.
Nader, yes, Ralph Nader.
Yeah, so I find it interesting. I lived in Florida in 2000, and I voted in that election. You know, the difference was only a couple hundred votes between Bush and Gore.
Yep.
And that at any time that votes were counted, or that your vote really, quote-unquote, counted, that was won, because really just a few votes, and it would have swung the vote, swung the election, the whole presidency, one way or the other.
Absolutely.
And that, for me in that election, I voted for the Libertarian Party candidate, and I'm glad. At the time, I was glad that Bush had won, because even though I voted for Harry Brown, I was rooting for Bush, and I'll get back to that on this podcast. About this election,
I believe, but I may have voted for Brown that election as well.
And so basically, when the election is over, and this is very much very likely this time, they're going to look at the difference between Romney's votes and Obama's votes nationwide, and they're going to say, oh, if Romney had only gotten this few votes that went to Johnson, then he would have won. And so my prediction is that Romney will win the popular vote, but he will lose the Electoral College.
Ooh, bold prediction. Like a number of folks are looking at that possibility now, given where the polls are, but mm-hmm. they're still ranking the possibility of that happening like in the 10%-ish range, not as a likely outcome, but as a possible outcome. But that would be an interesting scenario.
Yeah, I think it's getting more likely because Romney's, if you understand how the Electoral College works, it rewards someone who has a broad support across the country, not someone who has intense support in particular areas.
Right.
And so I think as the election gets closer and as it looks more and more likely that Romney may win, more and more of his supporters will come out and be enthusiastically voting for him in the election. But those people who are going to be voting for him
are going to come out in states like Texas where it doesn't make a difference.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's going to that's going to be the case that he's going to lose, but he's going to win the popular vote. And if that happens, goodbye to the Electoral College.
You know,
because the Democrats have been pushing that for a long time.
I still think it's unlikely that it would actually come together. Although this the popular vote project that's been going on to try to get enough states to agree to just abide by the popular vote, because you know, a little known thing for those who pay attention, the Electoral College, the sort of winner take all on each state, is not mandated at all in the Constitution. Each state picks their electors however they feel like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Yeah, the first part of our country's history, there weren't popular votes for the election at all. The electors were determined by the state legislators in most states. There are all kinds of other differences. A state could pass a law tomorrow saying that they would determine their Electoral College vote by coin flip. You know, perfectly legal. You know, or that the governor could pick, or whatever. In fact, that was brought up in Florida 2000 when it was going through the mess, is the legislature, after the election, could still have passed a new law that said, you know, never mind that popular vote. We're going to vote our Electoral College votes this way. And the state legislature could have done that. That would have added immensely to an already controversial election. But anyway, there are all kinds of possibilities like that. And the one that's been going around is there are a number of states that have agreed to a plan that basically says, as soon as enough other states have signed on to this, that would get to the 270 votes as 270 electoral votes needed to win the Electoral College, then they would begin allocating their electoral vote by the national popular vote rather than by the vote in their state, which would effectively turn American elections into a national popular vote.
Mm-hmm. The state of Washington has signed on to that.
The trick has always been in this area that this, theoretically at least, reduces the influence of small states. But really what you find out is most of the small states are really fairly partisan on one side or the other anyway. What this really reduces the influence of is the swing states. You know, so yeah, maybe you have this possibility. Now, I actually like the Electoral College. I think it's on balance a good thing for how we campaign because it does, you know, if you didn't have the Electoral College, the shift of campaigns, you know, it would all move towards, the high population areas and everyone else would get ignored. If it happens, it happens. But I think, you know, after 2000, there was the push and then you saw it disappear. Mm-hmm. And I think if it happened again, there'd be a push and then you'd see it disappear. I don't think you'd reach critical mass of something like this happening unless it reversed the outcome several elections in a row. Not just, two elections separated by 12 years. I don't think that would be enough. The other thing that could ever get it is if you ever do have a third party candidate who actually wins electoral votes and throws it into the House, that could also do it. Because the one election that was thrown into the House, the most recent one was 1824. And the interesting part about 1824 is neither the winner of the popular vote nor the winner of the Electoral College actually ended up as president.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the way that works. All kinds of interesting scenarios, but...
So getting back to Johnson...
Yeah, sorry. Back to this century.
It's so easy
century.
To get to... So getting back to Johnson, he... if you're in a state that is not a swing state,
yeah,
then the choice is easy. You know how your state is going to end up, and no matter how you vote, it's going to go for whatever your state is going to go for. And so what you want to do is you want to affect the next election, and or at least not even that, but you want to affect the policy, because if the Republicans lose this election by a margin that is less than the number of votes that Johnson gets, then there will be a move within the Republican Party to win those votes back. They won't like it. They'll spend the whole – they'll never admit it. They'll spend the whole time complaining about how Johnson – or those darn Johnson or Ron Paul Republicans are traitors. But in the end, they will – change their positions in order to get those votes next time. And I've seen it even now. I'm active in the Republican Party here locally. And, you know, I would think, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, these people hate me because I am a staunch Ron Paul, you know, libertarian. I'm pro gay marriage. I'm pro marijuana. And yet when I go to those meetings, they welcome me with open arms.
Hmm.
They hug me. They love to talk to me. You think that I was just buddy buddy with them all the time, and the reason why is because they need people like me. They need people, any people who are willing to work within the party and help get more votes for Republicans.
Well, and part of this is the difference between sort of party as, you know, some sort of ideological set of positions and party as like tribe and wanting to win. Because like what you see is a lot of the positions that, the Republicans are getting known for are demographically losing over time. Like we mentioned legalization of marijuana. Gay marriage fits into that same category. The percentage of people approving of that is increasing every year. They're on all of, not all of, but on quite a few of the social issues, you see the same story where the what has become sort of the hardline Republican position is a minority position and getting smaller. So to win, they have to reach outside of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so that's the strategic reason for voting for Johnson. There's, and so...
And I think you mentioned, like, in a state that's not a swing state, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, you should always vote for the person that you agree with the most, or, you know, maybe even factor in, you know, experience and stuff. Like, if I may agree with somebody 100%, but if I think they're not actually capable of doing the job or are, you know, emotionally unstable, I'm not going to vote for them anyway, even if they agree with me. But, you know... Aside from that, but if you are in a swing state, though, I definitely see the argument of saying, you know, I do like this guy, but I realize he's not going to win. So therefore, I think it's important to do my second choice because, you know, now if I really and truly think that my number two and number three choices are just as bad as each other, then maybe I'll still vote for the guy. But most people, I think... even if they like, say, a Gary Johnson or a Jill Stein or whoever best, if they look at Obama and Romney, still have a distinct preference between the two of them and think one of them would be more of a disaster than the other.
Yeah, and I can totally understand that. And like I said, I have experience being in a swing state, and yes, it can be very, I mean, if it turned out that, you know, that my vote was the swing vote, and which everyone's vote would be the swing vote in a certain in a state where it was down to one vote, but right. You'd never get to that anyway. Yes, I can see how that would be the deciding factor. But this goes into the area where of rooting versus voting for a candidate. I would still vote for Johnson no matter what, but I am rooting for Obama. And boy, that makes people around me cringe, even my fellow Ron Paul Republicans around me cringe, because I have different priorities of issues. Most people, as you mentioned earlier, most libertarians are of the ilk of economic issues primary, social issues are not quite so important, especially when it comes to war or foreign policy is not really the primary issue. But for me, torture and war and foreign policy are the primary issues, right, especially when it comes to the president, because of this. When it comes to domestic policy, the president really doesn't have that much power.
Domestic policy is really about Congress.
Exactly. When it comes to foreign policy, the president, this isn't the way the founders intended it, but it's just turned out the way it is. The president basically has a free hand. He can literally start wars, thanks to Obama and many others in the past, at will. And so when I look at the gravity of it, of the issues, when I look at, well, do I want to impoverish this country or do I want to take this country to war? Which to me, that is the choice between Obama and Romney. I think that Romney would manage the economy better than Obama. I think that he would reduce regulations. I think that he would be better at reducing the deficit and such, and having a better tax policy. But I'm also afraid that he will follow through on his promises to start a trade war with China, be belligerent towards Iran, if not start a war with Iran, start a war in Syria, build up our military more than it is right now, being bigger than the rest of the world combined. And so when I look at the gravity of killing innocents versus impoverishing this country, I would much rather impoverish this country than kill innocents. So that's the reason why.
Yeah, I'm
voting for Johnson, but rooting for Obama.
And from my point of view, I'm not actually sure Romney would be all that much better on the economy either, given, regardless of what they state the priorities are, the Republicans don't have a very good record on that either.
Because when I see him on 60 Minutes, when he speaks on, I was like, I agree with everything that Romney says, but you know what? I don't believe anything that he says.
And I think that's key. And I remember having a conversation a number of months back, essentially with that bottom line. Like, a lot of what the Republicans say, when it leave aside the social issues where I think they're completely off the reservation, but a lot of what they say when it comes to economy or whatever, I'm like, okay, they might have a point there. And maybe those priorities are okay, but then I don't believe a word they say. Because the record just isn't there. And the record in many cases is opposite, and you end up with policies that really are, it's almost like the Democratic caricature of them in terms of, doing things that, support big business and large corporations and the 1%, as they say, at the expense of a lot of other folks. And I don't think if you took the words, I'm not sure that's what it would end up as, but that's historically what it's sort of ended up as. And so I don't believe him.
Plus, if you listen carefully to the way he says things, and not just Romney, but I know Obama, but any of these high-level politicians,
yep,
they are so skilled in the way that they say things that you can never, take that quote into the future and say, look, what you said here, you're totally contradicting yourselves, because they phrase it in such a way that they can weasel out of it.
Absolutely. Not to mention that the people have very short memories.
Yes.
People have very short memories.
YouTube is awesome, though.
It is. But, I mean, even when you have the clip in front of you, people are like, well, yeah, but that was 2 years ago. Who cares what was happening 2 years ago? Let's talk about now. And so anyway, you mentioned sort of the growth of executive power over the years. I'll mention a book I read a little while ago, The Cult of the Presidency by Gene Healy. It very neatly took through, almost since the founding of the country, but concentrating on the last century or so, the continuous increase in there's a ratchet effect with executive power, that Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. Once one president has taken advantage of a new power, it's never going away. And part of that is also that Congress, you know, the original intention of the founders was that there would be this dynamic tension where each branch of government would defend its own prerogatives. Congress has long since given up defending its prerogatives. They don't actually want to make decisions and do things. They would be much happier for the president to do it for them.
Yes, unfortunately, that's a design flaw. Yeah.
So anyway, interesting stuff. We're actually getting up on an hour now, so that's usually what we target for the show. So even though we usually do four segments, we did three longer segments instead. I guess we'll wrap up the show. I'd like to thank you for joining us, Bruce. I appreciate you coming in.
It was my pleasure.
Any last words you want to add before closing up?
I very much enjoyed this, and there's a lot of other things that I'm sure that we'd love to discuss, and so. Just invite me anytime in the future, and that'd be great.
Sure, and hey, if you start listening, if you ever have any points where you want to jump in, let us know. And we do also, this show is an all-politics show. We also do tech. We also do other current events. So specifically, for instance, the announcement that everybody suspects will be the iPad Mini is coming this coming week. So there is no doubt whatsoever that Yvonne and I will be talking about that next week. So thanks again for joining us, Bruce, and thanks everybody for listening. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, anything along those lines. And specifically, we're still looking for someone to come on and defend Romney and give us, you know, the same way that Bruce today was talking about why we should vote for Gary Johnson. We want someone to come on and tell us about Romney, because, you know, Yvonne's pretty much a diehard Democrat. You know, I'm sort of this wishy-washy libertarian / Democrat, but I'm not even considering the standard Republican platform. I only even considered them when, you know, Ron Paul was doing stuff. So we want somebody. Come on, please, somebody. We're trying to recruit somebody to give that point of view. Thanks for listening. Goodbye, and tune in next week. Oh, and, you know, tweet us, tell your friends, all that kind of stuff. Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Say goodbye, Bruce.
Okay, bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.